one of the mistakes that leaders make is they want to address attitude. And I say, which drives them crazy, don't worry about attitude. Worry about behavior.
Welcome to Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. This is more than just a podcast. It's a front row seat to how elite leaders build the most iconic of teams. The kind of leaders who spot potential that others overlook, who build cultures people don't want to leave, who set the bar, then raise it. Work and how we work is evolving at a rapid pace like no time in history. Our guests will give you insights on how to stay out in front when it comes to all things talent, leadership, management, artificial intelligence, and developing the skills that actually matter. Whether you're a founder, hiring manager, or just obsessed with building teams the right way, this is your spot. If it's your first time here, welcome. Hit that subscribe button, drop a rating, tell a friend who gets it. To our longtime listeners, we appreciate you. Thanks for the continued support. Now, let's get into it. All right, listeners, today we are joined by a very special guest. Today's guest is Colette Brown. She's the Chief Human Resources Officer at Stony Brook University Hospital, one of the largest academic medical centers on Long Island, where she leads people strategy, leadership development, and workforce transformation. Colette has spent her entire career in healthcare HR. Before Stony Brook, she served as CHRO at Mercy Health System in southeastern Pennsylvania, VP of HR at Melmark and Presby's Inspired Life, and spent over 22 years as HR director at Crozier Keystone Health System. She's also a Lean Six Sigma Black Belt and currently serves as the president of SUNY, SUNY Human Resources Association. This is someone who has built, fixed, and rebuilt cultures inside some of the most complex organizations there are. But what really stands out about Colette is she just doesn't talk about leadership and culture in the abstract. She writes about it every week with real stories from the trenches. Toxic cultures, bad hires, the moments where leaders either step up or hide behind HR. She's direct, she's thoughtful, and she's got the kind of perspective you only get from nearly 40 years of doing this work. Let's get going. Colette, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Oz. Thank you so much for that beautiful introduction. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so grateful that you're coming on to our show. You've got such great experience, spend a lifetime in healthcare, so I want to thank you for that. Our company does a lot of work in the healthcare space. It just feels different. It feels like you're doing something that matters and of impact. So I appreciate you dedicating your career into this space. And you're out in beautiful Long Island, New York, right?
We are. It's absolutely beautiful here. Water all around us, gorgeous scenery, wonderful people. New Yorkers get a bad rap, but they're some of the nicest people I've ever met.
Especially in Long Island. It's almost a different type of person out there. It's almost got a little bit of a country vibe, like compared with the city. So I love it out there. How far are you from Long Island University? Is that close or is that?
Probably about half an hour.
Okay. I only asked that because the basketball tournament was this week and they were in the tournament. And they played my alma mater and I'd never known so much about Long Island. I did some research, found out about the Sharks. And obviously you're there at Stony Brook. So I'm so excited to get into it. Let's jump into it. Let's start here. How did you first get into HR? You've been in it for close to 40 years. Was it something that like when you were younger, you pursued or did you fall into it? How did it come about?
It was really accidental. Way back when in high school, I wanted to be a teacher. And my guidance counselor said, Colette, every girl on Long Island wants to be a teacher. You'll never get a job. There are too many teachers out there. So I didn't know what to do. So I just picked business as a major. And I wound up taking a couple of HR classes and really liked them. And way back then, just like now, it's always difficult to get that first foot in the door. So I wound up taking a job for a company that I don't even think it exists anymore. It's called Kelly Services. They were a temporary staffing agency. So yep. I took a job interviewing the temps and sending them out on assignments. And there was always a comedy skit every day with the stories we would get about why somebody couldn't make it or what somebody did. But it was really my first entree into HR because it gave me an opportunity to interview and screen people and work with customers and fill needs and so forth. So that's really how I sort of stumbled into HR.
I think Kelly Services, we'll have our fact checkers check this, was acquired by Manpower. But I do remember that organization. They did a lot of temp work. They did a lot of light industrial. That's amazing. And then obviously you started to move into healthcare. So you've worked in various health systems and hospital networks throughout your career. I'm interested, what's different about Stony Brook? What drew you to Stony Brook?
Well, a couple of things. One, it is, as you mentioned, Oz, it's the only academic medical center, and it's the only level two trauma center on Long Island, or in Suffolk County, I should say. And the quality of care here is exceptional. The patient experience, the commitment to the patients is exceptional. We had among the best outcomes for COVID during the pandemic. It really is an exceptional place to work. And I'm from Long Island originally. I spent most of my career in Pennsylvania because I married a Philly boy. So we went to the suburbs of Philly. And then when this opportunity came up, my mom was certainly older and I wanted to have some time with her. And I said to my husband, what do you think? And he said, yeah, let's do it. So it was a wonderful way for me to come back home and continue my career in really one of the premier healthcare organizations in the country. And it's just been such a privilege.
Quick aside, I married a Philly girl.
Really?
So we came down here to South Florida and we met down here. And I would tell you, after we got married, the first 5 years of our marriage, she was constantly like, we got to get you up to Philly. We got to get my family's up there. I want to be there. And I grew up on the West Coast of the United States. So like, there couldn't be more of a polar opposite, right? I had these like visions of Philadelphia in my head, like, didn't they boo Santa Claus? Didn't they? Aren't they like really rough and gruff up there? But I've since spent some time up there and great culture, great food scene. Yes. It's always nice to come home. So I'm glad that you had the opportunity to do that and for such a great organization. You know, one of the things that when we talked, we shared a passion for leadership, right? And how leadership has evolved and it's can be a fleeting thing. But I am really interested to hear, because I know it's important to you. Can you define what great leadership looks like to you? Like, how do we know when we see it, or how do you know it when you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is something that can be defined. It requires specific behaviors. I think people talk a lot about skills or a lot about traits. It's behaviors. It's what are we doing? What are we saying? And some of the things are starting with clear expectations. When we hire an employee, we want to make sure when somebody's promoted into a new job, we want to make sure that we're clearly explaining the role, the responsibilities. We're also giving them the sort of 10,000 foot view. Here's the organization's mission. Here's what we're trying to accomplish as an organization. Now let's zoom in a little bit more. We'll talk about the department's mission. Now let's zoom in a little bit more and talk about your role and how it ties to both of those missions. And then we get into, you know, the specific responsibilities, what does success look like? Talk with the employee about the tools that you're going to provide them with, what type of support, communication is available to them. So really setting them up for success from the beginning. And then I think where a lot of managers or leaders sort of drop the ball a little bit is ongoing feedback. We think, okay, we gave them all the instructions. They're good to go. They're off and running. And we get busy with other things. And we forget to check in as frequently as we can. We forget to give that directional guidance. You're on the right track. You're doing great. Love how you did this. Or can I make a suggestion? Maybe we could tweak this a little bit for next time. Really, that ongoing feedback is critical. Also, so important to recognize and reward contributions, celebrate people in the moment, let them know how much you value them and how much of a difference they are making in the work. And I say treat them as whole people, humans. You know, this is, I'm not just Colette sitting here at my desk doing a job like most other people. I'm a wife, I'm a mom, I'm a sibling. I have friends, I have hobbies, I have interests. Get to know us as people. And then the hardest part is ensuring an environment of what I call fair, compassionate accountability. So fairness means the same standards for everybody. We don't play favorites. We don't move goalposts. It's a fair environment. We know what to expect. Compassionate means that if there is something I need to talk with somebody about, I'm going to focus on the behavior or the performance. I'm not going to label or, you know, attack the person. And then accountable means that, you know, we make sure that we're doing what we say we're going to do consistently.
Beautifully articulated. I love that. Now, one of the things that I'll point out is that every manager should be a leader. But we know that's not always the case. But most managers should be a leader. But not every leader is a manager. So I'm interested when you have people who are maybe not have the authority, right, of a true manager, but are on a team. What are some of the things, if somebody's listening to this right now, is like, maybe I don't have the official title right now, but I want to show leadership qualities. Like, what are the things that you would recommend to them? Or what are some things that you see or observe in maybe future managers, right, who are showing and exhibiting leadership when they're not necessarily in that role?
I love that question. I think it's a few things. I think one is collaboration and inclusivity. It's asking people for their feedback, asking for their input, maybe even synthesizing all of that and saying, okay, great. I heard this from Oz. I heard this from so-and-so. Now it sounds like here's what we're saying, and synthesizing and summarizing it. Be somebody who is really engaged in and engaging others in problem solving. So, you know, okay, we talked about this as a challenge. Let's brainstorm some ideas, and that you're really leading the discussion in problem solving. But at the same time, we're making space for others. And it's not where I have to be, you know, leading the conversation or the star of the show, so to speak. I'm helping facilitate. I'm help generating these ideas, and I'm help bringing people together. And maybe even I'm gently helping alleviate tension or conflict. So if two people are starting to get a little heated, we're saying, oh, okay, well, I hear what you're saying, and let's build on that, and trying to redirect in a very gentle way to get the conversation back on track. And I think over time, people see those behaviors and those skills, and you start to earn respect as a leader. But it definitely has to be earned. It doesn't come with a title. And you can't demand it. And the more you demand it, the less you deserve it.
Mic drop, right? Early in career town. I hope you heard that. I hope you took notes. That was beautiful. That was wonderful. That was amazing. It sounds like to me that you've crossed paths with some great leaders throughout your career. So I'm just wondering, is there anybody that comes to mind that maybe informed your leadership style as you've made your way throughout your career?
There are a few people. I remember one woman who I worked with. She was a director. She was actually the chief executive officer for a teeny tiny community hospital that was part of our system in Crozier Keystone. Her name is Gwen Smith, and we still stay in touch. And she was just one of these magical, charismatic people who knew every single employee, talked with them on a deeply personal level, appropriate, but, you know, cared about them and their families, was just so incredibly sincere. And I still remember many funny HR stories in her office. But one of the things she said to me early on was, I'm like, Gwen, you are always like unshakable, so calm, so pleasant. Never saw her ruffled. And she said, she used to call me Colette. She said, Colette, you know, when people start getting agitated and the louder they get, the softer I get and the quieter I get. And she said, and it just brings the temperature down. And she was just really inspiring. And so many others. Diane Miller was somebody who was a mentor to me for many years, who was just incredibly passionate about what she did and incredibly efficient. My current leader, Carol Gomes, is the CEO of Stony Brook University Hospital. And Carol started here as a lab manager and is now our CEO. And she just has such a wonderful story. And she's a great model that respect doesn't come with title. It comes with compassionate leadership. And that's how she leads. And she's like, beloved. It's really inspiring.
Some of the best leaders that I can think of grew their way in an organization and saw different levels and different functions and had different like interactions. Like, of course, you can hire a great leader and bring them in and they can be ultimately successful. But I think there's something special about kind of working your way up the chain in the organization and, you know, winning through influence and winning through relationships. And that just empowers you even more as a leader, which sounds a lot like your current leader at Stony Brook. That's amazing. I appreciate you sharing that. You sound like you're in a great culture and a great environment. I'm sure you've played at least a part in that. But we see a lot on LinkedIn and social media about toxic cultures, toxic companies. If in case someone's listening who may be worried that they're in a toxic culture, a toxic company, what does one feel like when you work there? Because it might not be overt. Like, it doesn't mean like the trash can's on fire over here. Or, you know, there's bats flying around everywhere. Like, it's probably a little bit less overt than that. So tell us what it looks like and feels like in being in that type of environment.
I think it feels stressful. I think employees feel anxious, uncertain, that you don't know what to expect. There's not predictability. Perhaps, you know, there are different standards for different people. Perhaps some people's behavior is unpredictable. And that actually is more stressful than, you know, there's all this research that if you work for somebody who's chronically cranky, let's say they're not toxic, but they're just a little, you know, curmudgeon, that people deal with that because they know what to expect. But when you work with somebody who one day it's up and one day it's down, that really creates great anxiety because of the unpredictability. So I think it results in you know, stress and anxiety and discomfort and a feeling of things of life isn't fair, you know, and then people do one of a few things. They either shut down and continue working there, but they're disengaged, or they become resentful and maybe start behaving badly themselves, or they leave. So none of those are good outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I think is interesting is that, you know, what I've noticed in business is probably one of the hardest things to undo is a toxic culture, right? It's usually when it gets to a certain metastasization point, right? It's usually not like a one person type thing, like where you can just change it out or you can make one new policy or something like that. It's usually this thing that's kind of invasive, and it's like almost like a house with mold. You really got to get in there and you got to take it out. So let's say there, you know, but a lot of times CHRO jobs are open for that very reason. So somebody might be coming into a job knowing that there's something that they need to do to kind of move the culture into a more positive direction. So if you were advising a CHRO who took a job in a toxic culture, how would you tell them to go about turning it around? And maybe if you have any stories, if you know you did something that similar, or you saw something go from toxic to incredible, I'd love to hear about that too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it obviously starts at the top. So you have to make sure that you're working for a CEO who believes in, models it, and is committed to holding others accountable. Those are really the keys. And I think where it breaks down below that level is at the leadership level, where we have to equip leaders to get comfortable addressing difficult behavior. And I talk a lot about this because it's something I'm passionate about. I say, you know, one of the mistakes that leaders make is they want to address attitude. And I say, which drives them crazy, don't worry about attitude. Worry about behavior. Attitude is internal. Attitude is what we're thinking, what our mindset is, what our philosophies are. And really, we don't want to, nor should we, try to change what somebody's thinking. We just need to let them know what's acceptable in terms of outward behavior and then address that behavior. And then I think a lot of times leaders get stuck because we haven't been taught to actually pinpoint the specific behaviors that are problematic. And I learned that term pinpoint behavior when I worked for an educational and residential facility for kids and adults with intellectual disabilities. They had behavior analysts who worked with the kids, and it was their job to like pinpoint, specify, you know, their facial expression did this or this happened. And of course, we're not going to get in that detail, but what did they say? What did they do? What didn't they say? What didn't they do? Then we can move away from saying you have a negative attitude, which isn't going to change anything, and address behavior. And I think we also have to help managers get comfortable with conflict and do training around conflict avoidance and help prepare them for difficult conversations. Because it's only when we can start having those conversations one-on-one and doing other things as well, but we have to have those conversations one-on-one to move the dime on culture. If we tolerate it, as you said, it does metastasize. So we have to address it employee by employee, hopefully help them change, but if not, help them transition out.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire, the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, it saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
What a super profound thing to say. I'm not sure I've heard that before in terms of not focusing on the attitude, focusing on the behaviors, right? And then how that externally, you know, feels for other people and how that starts to impact your company. And it's a very smart thing to say because you can't go, like a lot of times, oh, I got a bad attitude, bad mindset. We got to get them out of here. You know, it doesn't matter if the behaviors are subjugated or they're not necessarily putting that out on other people. And a lot of times, it can be good to have different points of view, different perspectives, or, you know, be a curmudgeon or whatever it may be, as long as you have kind of like a good holistic tea altogether where it's not too much of any one thing. But the behaviors is what the key is. It's not what you're thinking in your head. We don't think whatever we want in our head.
Right.
It's just how is that impacting others around us? I really love that. Can you think of an instance where, you know, you were part of a turnaround or you saw a turnaround externally or, you know, anything that comes to mind?
I mean, I'll be completely honest that, you know, some of the worst behaviors are not ones where we've seen meaningful changes, but I do remember, and this was many, many years ago, we had a nurse in the emergency department. He was a male nurse, and he was prone to angry outbursts, you know, vocal, slamming things on the desk, you know, a lot of yelling. And the nurses were fearful of him, and they felt that they were going to be retaliate. And it's that whole victim cycle that we can get stuck in. And we had to really assure them that, look, if you report this behavior, we will address it. And then if it happens again, we will address it again. It will not be tolerated. And we went through a whole disciplinary process. We had the employee even go to EAP for anger management. He was a long-term employee. But ultimately, he couldn't sustain the behavior, and we did have to have him transition out of the organization. And that never feels good. It's not a celebration. Nobody's ever happy. But it did really change the work dynamic, and those nurses were able to come to work. I mean, we know how stressful working in an ED is. They're dealing with, you know, with life and death situations and taking care of patients that they're most vulnerable, and they don't need to have to deal with combative behavior in the workplace. So it really did change the work dynamic for them.
Yeah, and the focus should be on the patients and the patient's care. And if you're so concerned about the coworkers and how they're handling things, like it just takes away from that. And that's not, like, that can't be acceptable. So I applaud you for the way that you handled that. And it seems like you tried your best to make it work, but ultimately sometimes zebra doesn't change its stripes, right? So sometimes some of those decisions have to be made. And like you said, nobody celebrates that, but it is what it is. I appreciate you sharing that story, Clay. So let's jump into it, because I want to talk a little bit about talent. And I want to hear about your hiring philosophy. So let's start right there. Do you have a core hiring philosophy, either if you're hiring somebody for your team or what you would kind of advise your organization?
I kind of do. I think skills can be taught, can be gained. But I say hire for things like aptitude, drive, curiosity, you know, passion for learning, and definitely for values. I mean, give me somebody with those qualities and, you know, I'll be happy to train them on anything, because I can't train on compassion and kindness and all of those other pieces.
So let's use a real world example. Let's think of one of Stony Brook's values that's important when you hire somebody, and then a question you might ask somebody to determine if they have that value or not.
A good question. So let me think. I'll go with compassion. And I might say, tell me about a situation where you had to deal with a patient, a coworker who was having a very difficult time, and you were busy, you were rushed, you had things to get done, but you could see that they were really struggling with something, maybe personal or emotional, what have you. Tell me about how you handled it.
That's great. That's a great question to kind of drive compassion and understand, hey, even when you're not in your right state of mind, do you still empathize? Do you still have the ability to reach out and help somebody? So I think that's a great one. And I really appreciate you coming, giving something so tactical like that, because a lot of people listen to this and they're wondering how they can better interview and find some of these qualities. And that's a great question. Do you have a memorable interview that you think of? It could be good, could be bad. You don't got to name names, but I'm just interested. When I ask you about a memorable interview, what comes to mind?
I have a couple. I have one good and one not so good. My good one was, and this was super early on in my career, I was interviewing for my own admin assistant. And it was this woman named Patty. And, you know, I asked her all the usual questions and situational questions, and she answered everything beautifully. And then I asked her the very traditional, you know, what are your strengths? And she listed whatever they were. And then she said, and I'm fun to dance with. And I just thought that was so great. She had such a wonderful sense of humor. And I was like, this is somebody I want to work with. Not only does she have the skills, but she brings lightness and fun to the workplace. And she turned out to be great. She was an excellent admin assistant, and we always had something to laugh about, which was great. And the other one, I won't forget this one. This was, you know, I was working at the educational residential facility, and my boss, who was the COO, said, Colette, I want you to meet our finalist for the director of corporate compliance. He goes, you are going to love her. And this woman comes in, and first I want to say, you know, I'll talk a little bit about appearance, but from the point of view that this was a, you know, an executive position, somebody really who you wanted to make sure presented a steady, calming influence with great judgment. And the candidate comes in and she's dressed head to toe in lavender, a lavender hair accessory, lavender clothing, lavender shoes, lavender nail polish, and lavender eyeshadow. And I just thought, okay, from a judgment point of view, this is making me a little uncomfortable, but I'm going to stay objective. And during the interview, there was just red flag after red flag. I mean, she acknowledged having to leave jobs involuntarily, acknowledged having difficulties with her supervisors. And I went back and I told my boss, and he just like couldn't believe it. He's like, oh my gosh, she was wonderful when I talked to her. He said, maybe we should give her a chance. And I said to him, let me see if I could get one reference. And I knew it was a long shot because nobody gives references. But I called up her, I can't remember, I think, guess it was her most recent boss, and said, you know, told him why I was calling. And he gave me his spiel, can't say anything, yada, yada. And I said, I get it. I'm in HR. I completely understand. I said, can I just tell you that my boss really wants to hire her? I feel like in my gut, this is going to be a problem and we're going to really regret making this decision. I said, let me just ask you one question off the record. Should I trust my gut? And he said, yes. And I said, okay, thank you. And we didn't hire her. We hired somebody else who turned out to be excellent.
Wow. What is the deal with the lavender getup? Was she trying to be a fashionista or make an impression, or like what?
I don't know, but I just thought, you know, okay, you're director of corporate compliance and you don't want to draw unnecessary attention to yourself. You want to be
like
right.
Media or marketing, right? I could see it, but yeah,
right. You don't want to cause a distraction. You want to, you know, facilitate professional conversations, and sometimes they're very serious conversations.
Sure. I'm glad I didn't wear my lavender nail polish. Yeah, good thing.
It's okay at a party.
I love it. I was going to ask you, and maybe it's that admin assistant you brought, but when I ask about the best hire you've ever made, does anybody come to mind? And I'm just interested, what was it about them? And did you know it in the interview process?
Yeah, I love this story too. And I've hired a lot of great people and I work with a lot of wonderful people, but you know, Susan comes to mind. And I met Susan, I was interviewing for my admin went out on maternity leave. And the day before she was coming back, she said, Colette, can I come back part-time? I said, you could come back part-time if I could fill a part-time job and we'll do a job share. I said, otherwise, you know, we'll have to go a different route. Susan applied. Susan had been a stay-at-home mom for like 15 years. And on her resume, you know, she didn't have any current work experience. She put a lot of her volunteer work down, like she was the treasurer for her kids' lacrosse game, and she was the secretary for something else. So I interviewed her, and it was apparent immediately that she was really smart, very professional, very warm. And I gave her a lot of situational questions, and I gave skills tests. I had her do an Excel test right there. She was advanced, and I had her take minutes. I said, I'm going to tell you about the job, and as I am, please take minutes, and then I'm going to ask you to produce the minutes. She gave me the most beautiful bulleted list, summarized everything perfectly, and I hired her. And she turned out to be a superstar. I mean, over the years, she moved into a full-time admin role. Then I moved her into a comp specialist role. She didn't have any experience, but I knew all the stuff she did with Excel and with her kids' treasury stuff. And she was just so smart. She was a phenomenon. And eventually she became a director of compensation and benefits. She's my favorite story. And we're still friends.
Well, I got to ask you this, because this is a very like in the moment type question, because what happens right now is we have a bunch of AI resumes and we have a bunch of people reviewing a resume and looking for reasons to knock person out. They had two jobs in 3 years. They took a sabbatical. You had a resume that by all designs on paper didn't make any sense for what you needed. What was like, did something on there stand out to you? Or you're like, you know what? I'm just going to take a chance here. Like what caused you to do something that most people would not do?
I think because her resume was so beautifully organized, it was clear, it was succinct, and I saw the transferability of the treasury work on the lacrosse team and all of the volunteer work she did. I thought, well, she's got to have the skills. If she's the secretary of this and she's the treasurer of that, you know, she has to have the skills, and obviously she's somebody who likes to be busy. So I thought, well, you know, what can it hurt? Let's interview her.
I think that's something that everybody should listen to and take notice on, because we're in this world of looking for reasons to knock people out rather than bring them in. And then you can miss out on opportunities of somebody that not only was great for the job, but ended up ascending into a director, a compensation event role. That's amazing. I love that story. Thank you so much for sharing that. Let's go the other route now, though, because I know there's been misses. We all have misses in our career. Do you look back and is there like a theme of something that, you know, maybe you had to learn over time, or maybe a common thing that you realized that, man, when I thought it was right, but then I realized I made this mistake. Anything come to mind when I say that?
I think in general, it's probably when I felt rushed or pressured to fill a job. Maybe there was pressure to fill this seat, or, you know, I could sense the pain my team was feeling because we were short staffed. And, you know, the little red flags, you kind of ignored them or just dismissed them and thought, oh, maybe that wasn't that big a deal. And I think really it's when I haven't drilled down and allowed a question that didn't really reconcile to just go by and didn't dig deeper. And then lo and behold, I say those little red flags, they never just fade away. They just get bigger.
I think that's the number one thing. I think when you feel like you're under a pressure, you start to rationalize and you start to say, well, you know, do we want to keep the job open, or start to make mistakes? Because I'll tell you, there's nothing. The only thing worse than a job staying open a long time is making the wrong hire. That's for sure.
100%.
A lot longer time to unwind. What about when it comes to candidate experience? Is there anything unique you do to try to give people a sense of, you know, what it's like to work for you, or to what it's like to work at Stony Brook? Like, how do you create a candidate experience that is appealing, but also like gives a realistic job preview?
Well, you know, just the basic courtesies, you know, welcoming them, thanking them for their time, a little bit of small talk, trying to put them at ease, asking them, you know, do you want water? Can I get you anything? Just trying to make them feel as comfortable as possible, because that's what's going to provide you with the best insight into this candidate as a person as possible. I try to be, well, I am by nature, sometimes to a fault, very, you know, it is what it is. Here's who I am. And I'm very open and direct. And so I tell people exactly what it's like to work for me as a leader. I talk to them about, you know, I do have high standards, that we all work together. We're all committed to helping one another out. It's not my job type of role. Talk with them about, you know, what I provide in terms of support and communication and tools, and what do I expect from others. Mostly, you know, keeping me updated, letting me know if they're running into a problem early on so I can help. No surprises types of things. And just ask them, you know, to talk a little bit about how that aligns or doesn't align with what they're looking for.
Good stuff. Okay, I want to ask you a couple of day in the life things. So let's check in here. Have you read a good book recently that you'd recommend for our listeners?
Yes, actually. Well, first I'll preface it by saying I'm an Audible addict. So I listen to books, tons and tons of books, but mostly historic fiction or mysteries or a lot of classic literature. I actually don't listen to a lot of workbooks. I feel like when I'm not working, I want to unplug a little bit.
Got it.
But I did just read The Devil Emails at Midnight by Mita. I think her last name is Malik. She was on LinkedIn and I saw her advertising her book on LinkedIn. It was really a good book. She writes about all of the terrible bosses she's worked with. And the one was The Devil Emails at Midnight, was she had this boss who would email everybody literally in the middle of the night. And, you know, what a terrible message that sends to people for honoring their work-life balance. But I like the book because she doesn't just tell, you know, sort of the horror stories. She gives practical guidance on what are the best practices in leadership and how to make sure you're being a good leader.
So something that's interesting about that is, you know, as a founder, entrepreneur, my mind is constantly working all the time. I always say that I don't really ever disconnect. It's like, you know, one phase of like I'm home with my family, but also I might have an idea in the moment. And I'm somebody that needs to get something out of my head. Otherwise, I'll lose it, right?
Yep.
So what I've learned is timing of my email to come on Monday morning at 7 a.m. And so I will send the email, I'll schedule the send. And wouldn't you know it, iPhone came out with a feature that you can send your text at that time too. So now, it used to be a situation where like I'd write notes or I'd be like, oh my God, because I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to disrupt anybody. And I'm usually never asking for anything at that time because I think that's totally out of bounds. But I'm like, hey, this is something I want to talk about next week, or something that just came into my head. And so I realized that time sending, that's one of the best features that Outlook and iPhone had come out with. So never want to be the devil that emails at midnight, but I might be the devil that emails at like 6:30 in the morning Monday.
So. That's okay. We'll let that one slide.
Let that one slide. All right, Clint, how about advice that you'd give your 20-year-old self that you didn't know then, but you know now? Anything come to mind?
Yeah, my 20-year-old self was very naive and very, very sensitive. So I would tell my 20-year-old self, it's not always about you. So if somebody is being rude, if somebody is being dismissive, it may not be, you know, I would agonize. What did I do? What did I say? Why don't they like me? And, you know, lo and behold, they had other things going on. And similarly, like I was always somebody who would very much want to do an exceptional job, very much want to make people happy. And I'd, you know, feel like I'd go above and beyond for somebody. And then it didn't even seem to be acknowledged or appreciated. And again, I would get my feelings hurt. I would internalize it. Or maybe I'd go home and tell my husband about it. And he's like, okay. But, you know, those were the things that early on, that it took me a very long time, honestly, to say, you know, you have to just focus on doing what you're doing because it's the right thing. Contributing what you're contributing because this is who you are and what you want to do, and not worrying about whether you're going to get, you know, the recognition, the appreciation, whatever. And also early on in my career, one of my bosses said, Colette, you are never going to make everybody happy. And the longer you make that your goal, the longer you're going to make yourself unhappy. And it was good advice because obviously we want to make people happy. We want to do a great job, but you know, we recognize that it's all a balance. And I would also tell my 20-year-old self to buy stock in Apple.
Buy stock in Apple. That would have been the goal. Yeah. Google, Apple, Microsoft.
Yes.
Page. Well, listen, I want to ask you some Long Island rapid fire. Are you ready for it?
Absolutely.
All right. So let's start here. What is something that surprised you when you came back or maybe changed, right, from when you grew up there to opposed to coming back for work?
I guess what surprised me was nothing changed about Long Island. And I guess for me, that's probably because my family was here. So we were always coming back, like, you know, multiple times a year to visit my family. But what surprised me the most was how quickly my husband really adapted to it. We would always joke because he's from the suburbs of Philly. And of course, we traveled back and forth to Long Island. But, you know, he just loved being a Philly boy and all his Philly cheesesteaks and all that kind of stuff. And he is so immersed all Long Island. It's hilarious. He's walking to the little shops. He's made some really good friends. He's bought a Vespa. They drive their Vespas around together. It's just been, you know, I think he actually loves it even more than I do. So that's, I think, amazing. That was my
nice
surprise.
Okay. What do you miss about Philly?
Well, we were lucky enough that we kept our house there.
Okay.
So we were really fortunate because we do have family there and we do have a lot of friends there. So we go back, you know, probably once or twice a month on the weekends. So it's really been the best of both worlds. My husband says we're bi-coastal. I'm like, not quite.
Yeah. What's your favorite cheesesteak or your husband's favorite cheesesteak?
Oh, I am in big trouble. I do not like cheesesteaks.
Not at all.
No.
Is there any type of Philly delicacy that you love? Is there any, like,
not
the roast,
really.
The Knicks?
No.
No?
Cheese
okay.
Steaks to me are just super thin, overcooked. I'll get booed by everybody in Philly, but my husband makes up for it. He loves them and lives for them.
Yeah, I'm a Jim's guy, but I think that place burned down is what I was
told.
So I know.
I think he liked Jim's. He likes Pat's. And I think there might be a Joe's too.
Joe's. Okay. What's the best place to go eat in Long Island then?
We love this place in Huntington called Cassis. And it's a little tiny French bistro. Very authentic. Food is great. We actually have a young 20-something-year-old friend from Paris who came and visited us. And we took her to this restaurant. We said, okay, Lucy, tell us what you think. And Lucy has very high standards.
I would assume so.
And Lucy said, yes, this is authentic. She gave it the thumbs up.
Love that. Okay. Let's say I'm in Suffolk County for a weekend. What do I have to do?
I think you have to go to Port Jefferson. It's beautiful. It's right on the water. Tons of shops, tons of restaurants, things to do. Go out to the wineries. There are a ton of wineries out east.
I've heard that.
Yeah, yep. Beautiful. I mean, obviously go to the beaches, get some good seafood.
All right.
Ride some bikes.
Montauk, underrated, overrated, properly rated.
I would say properly rated, only because it's absolutely beautiful. It's really just breathtakingly beautiful, but properly rated because it's unaffordable. It's crazy expensive. You could go to Europe for a week for less than you can go to Montauk for a week.
Whoa, I did not know that. Yeah. Okay, well now I'm going to ask. I think I know where this one's going too. Hamptons.
Same.
Overrated, underrated, same thing.
And now very crowded, yeah.
Very crowded. Yeah, I mean, one of those bucket lists sounds a little bit too strong, but I've always wanted to go, you know, everyone talks about summer in the Hamptons and go enjoy it. And I kind of wanted to see what all the fuss is about, but to your point, it's not exactly cheap.
So it was especially fun when you were 20 years old and you went and, you know, shared a house with 20 other people. So it made it affordable, but I don't think we'd want to live under those conditions anymore. So sleeping on the floor.
No summer house for you. You did in Suffolk County and enjoy the time out there in Port Jefferson. Colette, been amazing. I love talking to you. You've got so much great things to offer. I'm so glad we got a chance to do this episode. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm looking forward to staying connected.
Oh, thank you, Oz. It was my pleasure. I appreciate it. And so much fun talking with you.
All right. You have a great one.
You too.